just on 7:30. We got a lot of material to cover tonight, so we'll go ahead and get started. So welcome all. If there's any new people with us tonight, welcome. We welcome guests at any time at any of our meetings. There are a couple of services that are only available to members, but most of our services are available to guests at any time. If you want to join, just go to the homepage and click on the Join or Renew button, and that'll step you through the process. And if you join by March 31st, you will get 2 years for the price of one, only $20. I'm going to go ahead and mute all right now. And as usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck in PDF format, the chat, and the audio track will go up on the website, courtesy of Alan. And with that, I'll hand it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Take it away.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Welcome, everybody. And we're going to start off with a follow-up from a few weeks ago. If you remember, Jen Rourke asked the question how to rip her DVD collection so that she could eliminate the actual actual discs and just have electronic copies. And she sent a follow-up. So she was glad that everybody, and quite a number of people suggested that it was going to be possible to do it, and various people suggested some software. In particular, Handbrake and VLC were the two main packages that were mentioned. However, she found that they didn't work in her particular case because of copy protection issues. But she does notice that she's sort of a variation of a computer Luddite, she says. So I think maybe slightly computer challenged in certain areas. However, she did do some further research on her own and identified a program called Video Prop Converter AI and found that the free version worked just fine. And then checked, there were three different paid options in increasing levels of both money and performance. She decided she needed the basic level, which was a one year option for $35. She figured that if it worked, then she would convert everything and that would be it basically. However, when she although the free one was working, when she tried to run the paid version, it wouldn't convert anything for her. So she had to read the actual manual, and then she found that there are actually two versions of this software. The one that she downloaded is specific for computers equipped with NVIDIA graphics cards, and in actual fact, she needed the other option, which was a non-NVIDIA program. Once she did that, then everything worked just fine. She scanned all her DVDs, they were converted, and ready to go. So she says thanks to everybody. So that's a Q&A success story. Okay, moving on, Chris has a follow-up about OneDrive.
Yeah, we had last week some talk about OneDrive and problems with it and workarounds and things like that. And I happened across this article that came out Alan, I think you got the wrong. Okay, there we go. So Chris Hossman at Computer World had an article on the five ways to fix OneDrive's worst annoyances. And they're outlined there. And if you're interested in working with OneDrive, I highly recommend you read the article. And it's well written and gives some useful information. So that's it for that one.
I like the last option.
I thought you might.
The next item is a question, Chris, for you.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Question for everybody.
Yeah, sorry, yep. Okay, so this is a question that came in from Chris Brown, and he said he was about to give up his landline, and two of the things that he thought were advantages of the landline was that it worked during a power outage, and it had slightly superior voice quality on it. But after he gives up the landline, he has an intention of having a Fongo home phone, which is a voice over IP, and it uses the router and internet connections, so it's not going to work during a power outage. And so he also wanted to have a phone that would work during a power outage, and he thinks that that may mean a cell phone. And so the question he throws out is, does anybody have an option or an opinion about the reliability of the various cell services you can get here in Ottawa during a power outage? So if anybody has experience with either good or bad or indifferent or anything dealing with reliability of cell services in Ottawa during a power outage, leave the comments in the chat. And what we'll try to do is summarize them all towards the end of the Q&A session and see if we have any feedback that we can give to Chris. And that's all for that one.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So our next item is actually a Canadian product that Jeff Dubois found, and basically a barcode scanner to identify Canadian products. And however, Jeff also found the developer, Will McReynolds, who's based in Owen Sound, and he's the developer of this app, and he's agreed to tell us all about it and basically how you actually go about developing apps for smartphones and tablets. So, Will, you need to unmute your microphone, and then the show is yours.
Hello, everyone. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, Ned.
Yeah, fine, thanks.
Awesome. Yeah, so actually it's more web-based. First of all, my name is Will McReynolds. I've been doing this for a very long time, it feels like. I used to do a lot of apps back in the early days in 2008, 2010, and I primarily switched over to web development for converting things via WebAssembly and other options to, I saw the path to a better future for many would be to democratize and make things agnostic by going back to the web instead of having them based on app stores controlled by other companies. So we spend a lot of money at our company building a platform, which is my day job. I'm a computer vision architect is my main gig, what I do. This just happened to be a project that my wife was sitting one night during a snowstorm here. Oh, by the way, Ottawa is a beautiful place. My daughter goes to Carleton. I love Ottawa. It's a long drive from here, but hey, it's worth the drive. So, I thought what would be handy is just to talk. Nobody really talks about or was willing to talk about the back end of things. And I thought maybe I'd share what I did to make this come to life within a night, using my skill set and what went into the ideation behind this, the thought process behind it, why I did what I did, and why I'm going to give the code away. I built this to actually make it open source. I'm going to give it away to people to develop it so they can integrate it into maybe grocery stores or wherever they want, because it's not my main jam. My company that we are what we do for other computer vision elements is what I really work on. So basically, I'm just going to share my screen here. If you haven't seen, I'm actually going to have a live demonstration here. Of how this works. If you haven't seen it, it's web-based. So I have to just go to skanuk.ca, and it's going to, you should be able to see any second you should be able to see my phone screen now, my video window. Do you see that?
No, you're not sharing right now.
No, it should be in my video profile.
Sorry. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm tricky like that. So if you go to skanuk.ca, it's just a web browser, so you don't have to install anything. Therefore, keeping it a Canadian product, this wasn't going to American-owned app stores via Apple and Google. So that was the first thing I wanted to do. So once people go to the store, all they have to do is allow permissions to the camera. And once they do that, the camera becomes enabled, and all the person has to do is just simply aim at the UPC, and it will come back and let them know if it was made in Canada or the U.S. I'm adding more features as we go along. I've recently implemented allergens so people can see if it's gluten-free or lactose-free. So there's a lot. I want to make it as handy as possible for the Canadians at large using it. I've made it so that people can update the database in real time as well, so that if products don't exist, they can add to the growing category. Right now there are 6.5 million products on there. I pull from an open pool of openly available data that's provided by US and Canada. So, you know, it's kind of funny. We have to pull in from US data because they have a lot more products. This wasn't really a concern up until a couple of months ago. And now that it is, people are scrambling. Other apps are out there using the same databases. So everybody's in the same boat of trying to make this as coherent and cohesive as possible. My goal is to make it agnostic. It works on a desktop. It works on an iPhone. It works on an Android. And if BlackBerry was still around, it would work on BlackBerry. So let me pull this up to – now, is anybody in this group coders at all? Is there any coders?
Yeah, a few people.
Okay. So I do a lot of stuff in C++ and Objective-C, but I had to kind of like go back in my brain a bit on this project to go back to JavaScript and HTML. So when I was building this, I wanted to make it so that I could give it away. So I had to go back to my roots in some ways. I have a team, right? So I've been kind of spoiled for the last couple of years to be able to come up with the shell framework of things and pass it off to people to finish it off for me. So this is really a passion, a labor of love, this one during doing this. So I'm going to share my screen here. And it might look complicated at first, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but some of you might appreciate what this is. It's only 1,000 lines of code. Basically, I have my main index, and that's just basically the schema, the shares. But what it does is when the actual component itself opens up, it comes up and asks for permission to the camera. That's very important.
Will, are you sharing your screen on Zoom?
Oh, you know what? It's in my camera. I'm so used to doing presentation the other way. I'll do it the other way. It's my camera feed. I control it from my OBS studio. My apologies. I'll do it. It's in my camera window. You'll see, but it's probably not ideal for you. Let me switch this over to screen.
No, it's my showing apologies. You the thumbnail now.
Yeah. I've got it. I do it a different way, guys. I don't use Zoom, so it's like it's fine. You guys should see it now.
Yeah, we do.
All right. So basically, it's very clean and organized. What happens out there in code land is a lot of people don't document what they're doing as they go along because they're in the zone. I am the same way. Every half hour, I'll try to go back and make a comment about what that was, but not just a random comment, something that actually makes sense so that when I pass this off to co-op students or when I put it on GitHub, people will be able to go through and see what this actually was for. So the main thing about this web-based utility was to make sure that it could come up, ask for permission, and also implement what's called a database failover. Now, what that means is I'm pulling from multiple databases. So the UPC reader will scan one database. If that product doesn't exist in that one, it will fail over to the next database, right? So we have four databases in play. And that database will check 5 times to ensure that it's not done. And this is happening in milliseconds. This is happening very, very fast. It's doing a couple of thousand hits within like milliseconds, right? So my background comes from server architecture. So building things on CDN, content distribution network, to make things as static as possible, to make them load as fast. And then you guys might appreciate this. So this HTML is just basically the look and feel of things. This is what you see with the logo, the Zoom bar, the privacy statement, the buttons to submit and donate a coffee are all within HTML. The script call is at the very end where it goes to a.js. I named it specifically Canadian, so eh.js. So when they go to the JavaScript, this is where it calls the function for the UPC scanner. Now, I didn't build this one. We have our own, but in order to keep it truly open source and away from our architecture, I used what was called Quagga, and it's a really robust minified library that you can use, anybody can use, and make it do whatever you want. In this case, I had just OCR the QR code to take off those numbers and then put it into a data field in the back end manual or automatically for the user, but that also allowed me to make a component that will allow manual submission, because sometimes certain QR or certain barcodes might be on a can. It might be too shiny. It might not be too small. Or you might just have to put it in manually, bottom line. So the fact that the field already existed for it to do it automatically for you, it just made sense to make open it up and allow you to put it in manually as well. I don't know if anybody uses Visual Studio, but basically this is the I always put my updates at the very top of what I've done on the JavaScript file, so that if anybody goes in here, they can see what I was last working on, what I've committed, what I've done. I create what's called a staging environment before I go live. So this is my staging environment before I push. This is where I constantly test some more, make sure it all works, and then finally when I'm happy with it is when I'll push to live, and then I'll test live and find out something that's broken, and I'll go back and fix it, because staging, no matter how many times I try, there'll always be something that might break for some reason, and it's usually during the obfuscation process. Obfuscation is very important if you want to try to protect some of your IP. I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but basically what it does is you can take your code and you can obfuscate it, and it just adds some randomized characters and other things and mismatches some stuff around, so that if somebody's trying to steal your code, it just makes it a little bit harder for them to try and figure out what you did. And we usually hide behind our IP. We have hidden behind our server walls. You can't actually even see it. Because it's so layer deep. This is front facing. This is all front end stuff. There's no really back end stuff happening on a massive level. So if anybody wanted to get this, they could just get it easy enough. So that's why I decided to give it away for free for people to develop and build on top. I think that's important as a Canadian. That's my main goal. My main goal is to build things for people that make sense in the climate of today, not just for this. But we have a communication platform as well that we're open sourcing that allows people to chat, text, and do video calls outside of the norm, right? But it's fully encrypted. So these are my passions, just to build tools that we can give the nationwide at large to help build better structures, especially as we need to. I was never aware of how important it was until all this started happening. I've been kind of living a life of privilege in many ways, not realizing how important it was to maybe look in our own backyard in some ways. So that's why I built this. My wife says, hey, you should take your gluten-free app and just modify it so it does this. So that's what I did. I banged this out on a Thursday night, February 6th, during a snowstorm. I posted it that night. It kind of went viral, and I've been building on top of it ever since. And I just wanted to show kind of the structure that goes behind it. Logo, index, privacy, service worker. A service worker is for doing the for adding to the home screen, so a progressive web app. So when people think of apps, they think of downloading from the app store. A PWA, a progressive web app, allows you to take a web page and install it on your home screen on your iOS or Android, and it behaves more like an app. It's got an icon and stuff. So it's important to make a service worker to make that all work. And as you can see, it's very basic to implement. A lot of people don't really know how to do this. You have to have a manifest, and you have to have a service worker, and that's pretty much it. So keep it clean, keep it simple, keep it organized, work with open source components. There's tons of things out there, and I'm happy to answer questions on these things. I just kind of want to talk about, you know, I didn't know what this group was going to be like, to be honest, is the bottom line. And I didn't want to make the topic too complicated or whatever. I just want to answer questions, maybe would probably be the best, I think.
Yeah, I guess most people, I think, are kind of end users. Maybe you could, can you give a demo of the actual thing in use?
Yeah, for sure. One second. Everybody can see this page with the product details? Okay, perfect. So when they go to Sconnect.ca, this is all you see. You see the disclaimer. You just go, I understand. And it's ready to go out the gate. So what I'm going to leave it for a second because it's there we go. That's what I want to have happen. So sometimes I want to help people not feel frustrated. Sometimes a barcode might be too hard to read. It might be bad lighting or something. So we want to make sure that the system goes, hey, this is taking a little bit. Maybe that's prodding them along and helping them out. So it comes up and says, do you want to put this in manually? You can go yes, and then you can type it in and submit it manually. If not, you can go cancel. It'll go back out to the camera view. All the person has to do is take the product and simply aim at the UPC. And it's that fast. It will just pull from the database and let the user know where it's from. That's what we really want it to do, is just quickly give a high-level version if it is, in fact, from Canada or the U.S. Now, what's interesting about this is I actually found some crazy things. Jack Links, beef jerky. I was doing that as one of my test products, and it says product of the USA on the front, but it was coming up as Canada. Well, on the back in tiny writing, it's an export of Mississauga. It actually comes from Canada, but they slapped a Made in USA logo on it. I found a Campbell's soup. It says it has designed in Canada on the front. It has a big Canadian maple leaf, but in the tiniest letters, it says designed in Canada, but it actually is produced in the USA. So this has been a really journey for me to actually learn using stuff. So like, for example, this can of this energy drink, which I probably shouldn't be drinking. Don't tell my wife, but I am having it. And if I scan this QR code, or sorry, the UPC code, I deal with QR codes all day at work, so I will call them QR codes. You'll see that this is a country of origin is the USA. So what's not reflecting right now is the allergens. But we wanted it to be simple. We wanted a product that would show it scans 6.5 million and growing out of the databases. So it doesn't just do food, it does products. So if you were scanning the box at Walmart of an item that's not food, like pliers or a CD player or whatever, it would tell you the country of origin of where it was manufactured. Any questions about that?
I noticed one of the things that happens is when it can't find the barcode, it actually asks you if you want to submit it. How does
that work? So basically what happens is, when I was explaining the code earlier, since I already had to make the logic for it to OCR the barcode anyway, that happens in the back end. So I just made the field public that made it so that you could let me just bring this up here. My apologies. So basically, you could just put in you would type in the digits on the thing. So on the bottom of this box here, I don't have my camera showing, but let me just go back out here. On the bottom, you'll see these numbers 64 064 113 688. So if it wasn't scanning that, I would put that manual number in, which I'll do real fast here. So I'll just type that in, 064 100. So it comes up with the same result because it's the basically you're just doing the manual entry. There might be times where the QR code or your camera, some older phones, this is why this exists. Some older phones might have a weak camera, bad autofocus, smudgy lens, scratched lens, a plethora of reasons that it might not work. That's why I added the scan function as well, so the zoom function, so that if there's a zoom function on the actual camera screen, so that if it's too small, it can help you in. There's a certain limit of devices that are older that just might not be the best to use. That's why that prompt comes up, because it's like, hey, I'm looking at your product. I'm pretending I'm the app for a second. The web application is looking at the barcode and going, yo, I can't find something, so I'm going to give a notification that I can't find something to give the user the option to manually input that option. So therefore, the user can still get a result even though their camera was not working. Or it might be a very bad lighting condition, or there's many reasons. I've made every angle I possibly can to help the user have the best experience that they can while I'm still rolling out features. If you saw this version when it first launched versus what it is today with what I've added to it and behind the scenes and the different things, it's a radical departure from the first iteration, which was just basically a camera field and a donate and give me some give me some coffee money button. It was a logo, the camera view, and buy me a coffee. It's evolved to report the bug, submit products, manual entry, share, all the standard things that you would expect from certain things, while keeping the UX and UI as clean, as efficient as possible, and big as possible, so that the average person, I'm working on a lot of accessibility for high contrast and stuff like that, which I know that, I know a lot of users will appreciate.
So does it work with produce too?
Yes, 100%.
There's a question in the chat, Will, from Natalie. She says, what types of products are in the databases?
Cosmetics, produce, milk, dairy, meat, clothing, electronics, like pretty much everything. And the list is growing as more Canadians submit things. Now, again, please keep in mind, this is not my database. I'm pulling from four different ones that are all being updated and vetted by peer-reviewed things, and then triple vetted almost to make sure that these products are in fact where they're coming from. So it's growing and it's getting better each day. And again, this all stems from the fact that it really wasn't a big concern as much as it is now. So now people are out there really coming together and making whatever submitted for my. When people go submit a product, somebody just actually click that button. So there's a submit product button. So if somebody clicks that, it goes to submit, and they can type in the barcode, the product name. So when that UPC code is put in there, it goes in the database. So when that scan is done, it checks against that database. The product name, the brand, the category, as you mentioned, what categories are in there, pretty much whatever you want, the description of it, the country of origin, and then that's double checked. By teams of people that control these databases, by a lot more Canadians, and this is where this gets awesome. Is like when you submit to mine, you're submitting to everybody else that's using the same databases. That's the beauty of this. This isn't just owned by me. This is helping out everybody at large across the board using these databases anyway. So that's where it becomes really. That's where it becomes really awesome, is the fact that this initiative is not just about Skanuk. It's about Open Food Group. It's about UPC Lookup. It's about old Scanada. All these different people that are making different things are helping out these databases become the best that they can be.
Why don't you let people submit a picture of the unknown object on this
There's an image URL.
I know, they're right there with the product, so they might as well take a picture.
Yeah, that would be coming, but I'm really about privacy. You know, it sounds all good and easy to say that, but here's the thing. I have been doing this for a very long time, and once I allow people permissions to the gallery, that becomes a real privacy concern for a lot of people. And I've really tried to keep this as simple as possible. That camera version is one thing. Accessing files on your thing is another. I've been trying to walk the line of keeping it as good as possible while I build this out with my own ethics of making sure people feel comfortable is the truth to that answer.
So you want to avoid dick pics?
Pretty much.
A question from Tim here. He says that he reads in the near future that companies are going to be replacing UPC codes with a QR code.
Yeah, that's true. And this is future proofed. It reads QR codes as well, because there's already products out there that are starting to roll out with that. So.
And then, what do you do if there's no QR or UPC code? There's another question here.
That's when the computer vision comes in handy. That's when you could use like something like Pastek or something to look at the actual image and have the image. This is my specialty. You could have the image check against a picture on the database to see what it is, and then bring back a call to say this is what it is. But again, I don't want to complicate it, because that's not what I'm trying to do here. That's what I'm going to give it away. This thing can have so many legs. I want to give the bare bones of it. and go, here it is, Canada, build on top of it, take it from, take the code and build what you want, or add computer vision. Because, again, once you start opening up the camera view to your home and everything else, that's the shit I don't want to be involved in, to be straight up.
Well, it sounds like you're modifying the thing quite a bit anyway, so I'm sure it's going to evolve as it goes along. There's a comment here from Natalie, says, a great utility. Thanks for considering the end users with issues like accessibility and so forth.
It's about making the best version of the open core, the open source that it can be for now, based on all these things. So nobody has to, I'm trying to do all the hard work, as much as the hard work as I can, and all those components that make the most sense, to let people focus on the other things, like those add-ons you guys are talking about, and they can do that themselves. I just don't want to be trapped in like legalities of hey, you're my kid somehow appeared on your database or stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much, Will. That was great.
Okay, so listen, guys, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Use it. Stand strong. Be free. True North.
Thanks much.
That was great. That was really great, Will. Just a quick comment. Yeah. I happened to use its first iteration when I first reached out to Will, and I can say that there's it's just been incredible to watch the changes as this has developed. Really good job there, Will.
Thank you so much. Like, honestly, in closing, just real quick, guys, I'm not trying to make a business off this. This is, I have a skill set. Not like Liam Neeson or anything. I have a certain skill set. No, I have a skill set that I want to help people out. And this is something I was able to do and give to the community at large. And that's my mission, honestly.
Okay.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Thanks again. Okay, so you should be back to my main screen, I hope.
Yes, indeed. And
you see, if you have no name Mate Baked Beans from somewhere, then it is in fact a country of origin, Canada. And another neat thing, if you're allergic to mustard, then watch out. Okay, moving along, I think the next item on the agenda is a follow-up from Chris.
Yeah, so at the February 12th meeting, I gave a presentation on how to buy a PC. And during that, in the chat, we ended up with, and if you got the right window enabled there, there we go. Okay, in the chat, Bob Harris said, Chris, what's your fancy monitor divider? And I didn't know what he was talking about at the time, and I realized later on that the question related to my comment that I was using fancy zones on a single large 4K monitor to keep things organized on the desktop. So I decided to do a little bit follow-up and a little bit more deep dive on the Microsoft Power Toys, and in particular, fancy zones. So the Microsoft Power Toys, recap on that, collection of free utilities that enhance Windows. It started out with Microsoft programmers, and it was made available on GitHub as open source, and there are many contributors to the project outside of Microsoft now. Currently, there's 27 different utilities that are bundled into it. If you want them, you go to the Microsoft Store and search for Microsoft Power Toys. You'll see it come up at, like, the screenshot there, and then you install it. You have to install the whole bundle. You can't just install just, for example, Fancy Zones, but you can disable any that you don't want or don't need. And a key thing in all this is the activation keys are customizable for all of the Power Toys. So I'm going to talk about Fancy Zones. The Fancy Zones is a window manager, window in terms of the windows that you see on screen of your application windows, so you can organize them on your screen. It's a very, very customizable version of the Snap layouts in Windows 11. And if you use Snap layouts, that's great, but it only works in Windows 11, doesn't work in Windows 10. But Fancy Zones will go well, well beyond what you get with that. Just to look very briefly at Snap layouts, if you drag a window towards the top center of the screen, you'll get something that pops up with these different layouts available. And then if you just drag the window into one of the squares, it will snap into that position on the screen. Or you can hover your mouse over the maximize button of any window and the layouts will appear, and then you can just click an area where you want it to fit that particular window. So that's Snap Layouts, non-customizable, very useful in their own regard, but Fancy Zones is much, much better. So once you've installed them, you double-click on the Power Toys icon in the system tray, and it could be hidden under Chevron if you have it as a hidden icon, and it'll bring up the dashboard. And on the dashboard, you find the Fancy Zones, and you toggle it on. It'll be toggled off by default. And then you can launch the layout editor. So in the layout area, it comes up like this, and there's a row of templates, and then there's custom. And the custom will be blank when you first go in, though that's the area for any layouts that you create. So just to give a try at it, I highly recommend that you just try out one of the layouts. One of the ones that's reasonable that is the columns layout. So if you do that, it'll just set it up for you, and you can start using it immediately. So say, for example, on here, I have Microsoft Word in a window that's more or less in the center of the screen, and I want it to snap into a particular zone. So all I do is click and hold the mouse on the title bar of Word, I drag it, and I hover it over. As soon as it goes into a particular zone on the screen, it will highlight that zone. It also numbers the zone. You can see very faintly 1, 2, and 3 as the three columns that are available. And then all you have to do is release the mouse button, and then that Word window will snap into that position on the screen. And you can release the Shift key after that. So that's the way it works for dragging in operation. But now what gets really interesting is when you create your own layouts. So you can press Win plus the backtick key, which is on the tilde key on the keyboard top left, and it'll load up the Fancy Zone editor. And it comes up looking like we saw before, where we can choose a particular layout. But now what you can do is you can decide, okay, well, let's create something from one of the templates. So I'm going to right-click on the three-column template because maybe that's something that is close to what I want anyways. So I right-click on it, and I choose Create a Custom Layout. And then it will create a custom layout down in the custom section, and you can choose any of those, and you click on the pencil for it, and it will go into the editor. Or you can click on the button to create a brand new layout, and it'll be blank layout. So once you get into the editor for it, you can rename the layout to whatever makes sense to you. You can have a shortcut, which can be really, really handy, because you can use Win, Control, Alt, and a number for the different layouts, so you can switch between one layout and another instantly. If you want space between the zones, you can actually include some number of pixels in between each of the zones so they stand apart from each other a little bit. Well, when you, what I found was if you drag these, slider on that, it's really hard to get exactly the number of pixels you want. So if you just click on that slider, and then you can actually use your arrow keys to adjust the pixels one by one. And then you can highlight distance, which is the how closely you have to be on a particular zone before it actually detects the zone. And then you can click on that pencil icon in the middle to adjust the zones, to increase the number, decrease the number, the size, the positioning, and so forth. When you click on that, it brings up your entire screen, and there's a dialog box in the middle that gives you instructions on how to adjust your zones. And you can add zones, delete zones, adjust the slider so that they're bigger or smaller, and so forth. So all the instructions are all there for you. And a great tip I found on this is you'll notice the background. It's actually showing me my desktop. And so what I suggest that most people do is when you're at your desktop, set up your zones how, like just with random windows. It doesn't have to be specifically the windows you expect to be using, but just set up your windows on this desktop the way you would like them. Then go into the editor, because when you go in, you'll be able to see your windows in the background, and you can adjust the zones within Fancy Zones to match what is in your background. So it makes it a little bit easier to adjust things the way that you actually want them to be. There are two types of zones. You can have a grid, which is the ones we've been looking at so far, and it starts off with a, in this case, a three, it's not a three column, sorry, it's a three boxes grid. And then you can create additional zones by splitting existing zones. You can merge zones together, whatever you want. And then the big thing about the grid is that zones can't overlap. But there is another type, which is called the canvas. And it'll start off with one zone, and you can add as many zones as you want, and they can be moved, resized, and they can overlap if you want them to overlap. Some of the finer points on using fancy zones. When you're dragging a window to different zones, as you pass over to adjacent zones, both zones will be highlighted, and you can drop the window right then to have the window snap across two zones, which can be kind of handy in certain circumstances. You can override window snap, and if you do that, the normal window snap is Win plus the arrow key will snap a window to the left side, the right side, or whatever. There's a couple of settings for it. And if you override that, it allows you to use Win plus the arrow key to snap the zones, the windows to zones, rather than using the dragging of the title bar of the window and having it drop and then dropping it into a particular zone. So I find that to be very handy to speed things up for moving windows around multiple zones. If you have multiple windows that are snapped to the same zone, when you're on that zone, you can use windows and the page up and page down to cycle between the windows that have been snapped to that zone. It can be handy. There are lots of options dealing with multiple monitors. If you have multiple monitors, you can have zones spanning monitors. You can show the zones on all monitors, all kinds of things, if you have multi-monitor, which can be really useful. And there are tons more configuration options, and I'll paste into the chat window for the link to get to the information about fancy zones. And that's all I have to say about that.
Thanks, Chris. There are a number of comments and questions in the chat.
Okay.
To get to them.
Why do you need different zones? So Carol asked, why do we need different zones? It's just that I like to have things where I can see all of the windows that I'm going to be working with at the same time. So I might have a web browser and a word processor and a spreadsheet, and I want to have them all visible all at the same time. So you can drag windows around and arrange them, but if you have fancy zones installed, you can just have zones set up for those three windows, and you can just drag them, drop them into them, and then all three of those windows will be fully visible all of the time.
And before that, Natalie says she often gets a prompt to update PowerToys on her PC. And does that mean that she has everything available?
Well, when they do come out with a new version of PowerToys, it could be as simple as fixing bugs in one or more modules. It could be adding a new PowerToy. So it could be any change really happening at all on it. It is usually they will fix a number of bugs. They will usually come out with some enhancements to existing toys, and then occasionally they add in a new toy. So whenever they have new PowerToys available, I always go ahead and I update it. And when you update it, you will get a screen that tells you about what's new in that particular release from the previous release, and so you can delve into what's been fixed and what's been added.
And as you said earlier, if you install PowerToys, you get all of the PowerToys. You've got really no option, right?
Yeah, they're always all there. I turn some off that I have no interest in it and I don't want to accidentally activate them, or they may be always running in the background, consuming a little bit of CPU or something like that. So anyone that you don't need at all, I would suggest just turn it off. But they're all there all the time, so you can toggle them on for any time you want to use them.
And Tom says he uses the text extractor tool almost every day, including catching URLs on our Zoom calls.
Yep. Yeah, the text extractor is great. Yeah.
Natalie says she just tried it to copy from the PowerPoint slide. It wouldn't be possible with regular cut and paste, but thanks for the tip.
That's right. Yeah, it's great.
So does that mean I can do that from while I'm sharing my screen too?
I would assume so, yes.
Okay. Tom says he thinks Windows 10 natively supports full and half zones with the Win plus arrow keys.
Okay.
And Bob thinks that monitors can never be too big.
Yeah, that's true. You can never have too much screen real estate.
Okay, I think that's covered all the all the chats in the comment there. Okay, so a question came in from Elizabeth in terms of Google fingerprinting. What's Google up to? What is digital fingerprinting, and is that a new thing? And Chris and I didn't know, but I asked Mr. Google because he probably knows. So it turns out it looks as though Google is trying to get rid of cookies. And instead, they're going to implement these things called digital fingerprints. And basically what they're doing is, rather than, you know, putting a piece of code on your computer, they're basically collecting everything that they can find that's lying around on your system, including the operating system, the browser that you're using, your IP address, plugins that might be installed, the time zone that you're in, the language that you're using for your keyboard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's many individual items that, are on your particular computer. And the more they have, the more likely it is that they can identify you. So that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to set up a massive amount of pointers that will create a unique profile for you, which they're calling a fingerprint. And the thing is, right now, you can get rid of cookies, but at the moment, you don't think you can remove fingerprints. So one of the articles I looked at was from Malwarebytes, the antivirus people, and they suggested a number of things that you could do to try and avoid fingerprinting. And one of the things is to move away from Chrome. Chrome, of course, is Google's browser. So if you can find a browser that is resistant to fingerprinting, and they suggested, for example, Firefox, which is a Mozilla product, and Brave. I don't know who produces Brave, but that's one of these privacy-type browsers. And look for anti-fingerprinting plugins, but they didn't give any examples of that, and I didn't see anything on the web when I did a cursory search. And you could try using a VPN, because that will give you a different IP address. I guess one of the problems there is if you use a VPN, it always goes to the same server, and it's still going to identify you based on that IP address. And they also suggest maybe you could disable JavaScript. Maybe that will help. One of the problems is, as Chris keeps telling us, some websites rely on JavaScript to show you anything. So you may end up seeing blank screens, or the system may not perform as you think it should because JavaScript's turned off and the website is trying to activate scripts to do things. And one of the things you can do there is use a plugin to temporarily turn off JavaScript so you can toggle it on and off. That works quite well. So those are some of the, if you're concerned about fingerprinting, those are some of the things that you should be looking for and researching a bit more than I have done in this item. But for example, here's an installation of Brave, and this is the settings in Brave. And you can see down here that there is a toggle to turn on block fingerprinting. So sure enough, Brave is aware of that as an issue and does give you an option to try and avoid it. Okay, that's all I have. I don't really know much about it, but certainly if anybody can provide more information, then let us know. Okay, next up, Chris is going to solve all of the problems that we have with AI.
Well, it's more a cautionary tale about when you are trying to solve problems using AI. When you're asking for help, sometimes it can be really, really hard to explain exactly what it is you want the AI to provide for you. You will find that AI will sometimes ignore some or all of your instructions. And it may be an iterative process where you have to solve a problem in successive chunks before you can actually get to the bottom of it all. Now, my slides are going to have a lot of information. I'm not going to read everything by any stretch of the imagination. Alan, have you... Oh, there we go. Okay. I'm not going to read through everything, but you can look through the details later on if you're interested in the nitty-gritty. So I had an Excel problem where I had a database in Excel look something like this, where I had a list of phone numbers. And some of the phone numbers had area codes, some of them didn't have them, some had no number at all. And I wanted to normalize this so that I could deal with things more logically, like I could, you know, always check for, you know, a particular area code. Even if it hadn't been listed, I was going to assume 613. And I had thousands of records to actually deal with. So what I needed was any phone number without an area code, add 613- to the start, just making an assumption that it was that. So I went to Perplexity AI, which is one of the best AI engines for doing Excel solutions I've found. And I thought it probably wouldn't understand in a prompt saying without an area code. So I decided, how could I explicitly say what I wanted? So I said, if cell E2 has a content that is three numbers followed by a dash followed by four numbers, so that would be a phone number without an area code, reformat it so that it has 613 followed by the current contents. Fairly straightforward. So it came back and, oh, yes, we can do that, of course. And it came up with a solution of using concatenate, and it comes up with a nice, clean explanation about what that will do. So let's do that. So we put in the cell concatenate 613 and the contents of E2. Well, that's obviously not what we really wanted. I replicated that all the way down, and we can see that all it did was it just added 613- to the start of everything. Well, that's not what I wanted. So if there's no phone number, we didn't want it to have just an area code, but we'll come back to that one as a later on problem. So if we look at the initial query, you know, we said if it had content is three numbers followed by dash followed by four numbers. Well, what if I added in a condition? So there's follow-ups in Perplexity AI. And so I said only do the concatenation if the current contents of E2 are three numbers followed by a dash followed by four numbers, which is what was in the original query. So I do that, and it came back and, oh, certainly we can do that. And it came up with a new formula, and it came up with a good explanation about what was going on. And so let's try out that if and len E2 and so forth. And we do it in the first cell, and sure enough, we didn't get an additional 613 added to it. We replicated that all down, and it was great. Anything that already had an area code, so if we look at line 6, you know, it was area code 416, and it was left as that. And line 3, which didn't have an area code, it did have 613- appended or prepended onto that string. So it looked really good, except we didn't want zeros added in on the cell, because they were saying, and in the explanation, they actually said, if it didn't match that, leave it as is. Well, it didn't leave it as is. It put a zero in its place. So we added another condition to it, and we said if cell E2 is currently blank, leave it blank. And then it came up with yet another formula for us, and if we plug that in and we replicate it down, it worked perfectly. So did everything that I actually wanted it to do, and then I had a little bit of cleanup to do. Column F, the normalized phone numbers, had a formula rather than the actual numbers, so I wanted the numbers in there as plain text so that I could do queries on that. So I selected the entire column, I copied it, pasted it back over top of it as paste values so that it got rid of the formulas and just put the numbers in place. I deleted the original phone number column and then renamed the new column to phone. And I had exactly what I wanted. It was done in about 5 minutes. It probably would have taken me hours to actually figure out how to do that on my own. So I think it was a success. But then I thought, well, could a different AI do better? So there's a new wunderkind on the planet, DeepSeek R1. And NVIDIA happens to have an implementation of DeepSeek where your data doesn't go off to China. So I thought I'd use that and try it out. So DeepSeek R1 took headlines all over the world a couple of weeks ago, caused NVIDIA's stock to drop dramatically and so forth. So it's called an advanced open source language model. It excels at text tasks requiring advanced problem solving, logic inference, so forth, articulate its reasoning process, and so forth. Sounds like it can do everything but slice bread. So let's try it out. So I pose the exact same problem that I had before. In Excel, if cell E2 is content, three numbers, followed by dash, followed by four, reformat to put 613 at the start, and so forth. So I go back to my original data, which I show there. And I got an answer in 1,391 words. And it argues with itself as it goes through four pages worth of explanation and reasoning and things like that. And you can have all kinds of things where it says, oh, but wait, what about this condition? Oh, but if I use that condition, this might happen. What if I have a special case of this and I have to deal with that? And so forth. So over the course of about 5 minutes, it actually came up with a final answer. And it came up with an answer. It's different than what Perplexity AI came up with. But then I said, well, is it right? So I take my original data, and again, I paste it into the first cell. That looks good. I replicate it down, and it looked good, except for the zeros that were put in when there was no phone number at all. Now, I didn't want to go through another 5 minutes waiting for it to come up with how to adjust the formula so that it didn't have a zero when the phone number had been blank, so I just left it at that point. So it was a little bit better than Perplexity AI in that it got it probably would have gotten the solution in one more iteration. So with two iterations rather than three with Perplexity AI, but Perplexity AI ran an awful lot quicker. So final conclusions. AI can come up with very reasonable sounding solutions that are wrong. You have to be skeptical. Check the results. Check that they make sense. Check that the results are correct. Overall, will I continue to use AI tools? Oh, you betcha. I mean, but I will be skeptical. I will check the results, but they are very, very useful tools to have. And that's all I have on that.
It's kind of interesting that it didn't pick up on the hyphen followed by four numbers.
I know. That was dreadful that it did
that. I told it exactly what you wanted.
And then when I told it again, then it decided, oh, okay, you really mean it, I guess. Okay, and the next one is mine. Actually, was there anything in there?
No, there's nothing.
Okay, good.
Related.
Okay, the next one is mine too, and this is AI mistakes. So I wanted a graphic to illustrate the previous slide going back to talking about cell service. And so I wondered, could AI generate a graphic for me? And so Chris Brown had talked about, you know, moving from a landline to a cell phone. And so I thought, what about a graphic with two people, one of them using a cell phone and one of them using a landline? So I went to ChatGPT, and I asked for a pencil sketch of a woman talking on a cell phone. She's facing a man who's talking on a landline. What did it come up with? It said, here's that pencil sketch of a woman talking on a cell phone. Only she's not on a cell phone. So I did a follow-up. I said, make the woman's phone a cell phone. And it came back and said, the woman is already using a cell phone. Well, not really. So I tried, well, make the woman's phone a mobile phone, not a handset for a landline. And it came up with another one, and they took away the curly cord on her phone, but other than that, she's still using a handset. And I thought it kind of curious that this handset was glued to the side of the guy's head. So I considered that to be pretty much a fail. So I just thought, well, there are other AI tools. How about Microsoft Copilot? So I did the exact same prompt, and sure enough, not a cell phone. And I went to Ideogram, and it came up with four solutions for me. And we have a woman talking on two cell phones. And I wondered about where the handset is plugged in. And in this example, I wondered about a landline out on the street. And it came up with two that were actually not bad. And I actually used the top one to illustrate that slide earlier in the deck. So, you know, I mean, AI can do wonderful things. You have to check it. You have to be skeptical. And you sometimes have to try again and again and again to get what it is you actually want. And that's all I have for that little humorous add-on for today.
I think at least they mostly have four fingers.
That's true, yes.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. Okay, so we're in the last 10, we're in the last minute. Anybody have any additional questions? I noticed one of the, there was quite a bit of chat about the cell phone outage question. I think one of the things there was, I don't know if anybody mentioned, but clearly one of the things you'd like to do is keep his router alive if there's an actual power outage.
Yeah.
How would you go about doing that?
Yeah, I think that is a key point to it, that he could forego worrying about having a cell phone. If all he wants is in a power outage, he could power his router from a UPS. Now, UPS is generally only going to give you a couple of hours in that, but at least it would give you short power outages. Beyond that, if you have a generator, you know, you could power your router from the generator, and then as long as you have gasoline to power your generator, you'd be good to go. So there are some other solutions on that front, too, that might be better solutions or cheaper solutions overall than dealing with having a cell phone that you may not need for anything else.
If you only is non-electronic hand.
If the only requirement is to use the phone occasionally when there's a very rare power outage, the most affordable option is probably 7-Eleven Speak Out. It's an annual fee of $25. It gives you $25 worth of talk time. I think it's about 15 or 20 cents a minute. And if you don't use the time and you renew it before the year at 364 days, that time rolls over. We have an emergency backup phone in the car that we use precisely for that in case, you know, there was a problem, we forgot our phone, and then we're in an emergency situation. So that's an option, 7-Eleven Speak It.
Also, if you really only need it for a real emergency, any cell phone, you know, as long as it's powered, even if you don't have a plan for it, you can call 911 on it and it will work.
That's
also,
true.
Also, regarding, so you can keep like an old cell phone in the car and charge it every month or so and leave it there. Also, regarding the UPS, the UPSs that you can usually buy or something, they will last about, you know, 10 to 15 minutes if you're running a computer and a monitor and as well as the router. If you only want to run the router, it'll probably run the router for about 10 or 12 hours. But yeah, you will need something, the other things that are connected to it, like a computer would have to be a laptop and it will run off its battery, or a phone.
Yeah, but if you are concerned about it, just to be able to have your VoIP operational and you could shut down anything else connected to it, yeah, that's a good point. You could probably get 10 or 12 hours out of it, so it might be enough to handle it.
And UPS is about that size, run about $100 to $200 or so.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Yeah.
Okay, well, if anybody has any other bright ideas, you can always send it in to suggestion box and we'll...
Yeah, I don't see Chris on the call tonight, so I will pass on to him that there was a bunch of information in the chat, and he can pick it up off of our website along with the audio track.
Okay, so the wrap-up slides. Just remind everybody, I remind members of the club that we have our one-on-one remote assistance program, so if you have issues that you think people can help you with by... being able to look at your screen and tell you what to do, then you can send in this request to the email here, one-on-one request, and tell us what you're interested in, and we'll see if we can find somebody to help you. So that's if you're a member of the club. If you're not a member of the club, Chris mentioned when we started off, we have this special two-for-one offer right now, whereas if you join the club for $20, the annual fee for 1 year, before March 31st, we'll give you a second year's membership at no cost. So this is an opportunity to shop local and certainly buy Canadian. We only accept $20 Canadian. But if you are a member, don't send us $20 because the board will renew your membership for an additional year at no cost to you, out of the goodness of our hearts. One of the other things the club does, which is available to all the public, are presentations at the library. And coming up in the next week or so, slide presentation on the Baltics from Linda. Chris is doing quick PC tips. And if you don't want to go to the Baltics and you'd rather go to along the Danube, then Linda's doing that too. So those are options at the library. You have to register with the library for those. Our main meeting in March is on the 12th, and we're doing smartphone essentials. So if you have an app that you'd like to share with the group, please let us know. We're building the deck and the agenda as we speak. And talking of which, Bob Harris wants to know if anybody is interested in providing an app, if you need any more information, or maybe you need some help to produce a few PowerPoint slides to demonstrate your product. And if you want to hang on after the meeting here for a few minutes, we're available to discuss all of the above. And finally, our next meeting will be next Wednesday, March the 5th, be a regular Q&A. If you have more questions, you've got input from some of the things that have been talked about tonight, or if you've got new topics that you'd like to share with the group, again, just let us know at the suggestion box address, and we'll be happy to add you to our future agenda. So, pretty good range of topics tonight, and a lot of material. We got through most of it within the hour. So thanks for your attention. Hope you enjoyed it, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. And as Bob Harris mentioned, hang around if you want to talk about the coming up, the smartphone basics or favorites for March 12th. If you have any questions or want assistance, by all means, hang around and we can discuss that.
Yeah, I'm sure many people have an app that they can share in 2 weeks from now. And if you're a little stuck on doing the PowerPoint presentation, I know Alan and Chris will help you make one, and I'll do what I can also. We only want about 5 minutes from a few of us, and if we can get together and share whatever you can, we'll do most of the grunt work for you, and I'll do my share of it too. So what do you folks use, please, on your cell phones?
And if you let Bob help you with your slides, you'll get all the singing and dancing options in the graphics.
Yeah.
Well, I've started making a list for this meeting about the ones I use. I've made a presentation already on, I think, the atomic clock, and maybe not the authenticator, but I also use there's an Aurora alert. There's an authenticator for two-factor authentication.
Aurora one might be cool, Tom, if you wanted to do a presentation on Aurora.
I haven't gotten any alerts from it yet, so,
yeah.
So I really can't make a presentation on it just yet.
Yeah, actually, this is not the time of year in Canada. Well, we haven't had Auroras. I had the app on my phone, and I got an alert a couple of weeks ago, but it was not a high probability one. So,
Authenticator, Avenza for outdoor recreation maps, BA Calc for a business calculator, a barometer. Most smartphones actually have a barometer inside, so you can actually get a barometer. You can probably get an altimeter, too. I haven't looked for that, although I have it on my watch. GridSpace Online, which I've done a presentation on. Big Ben for regular chimes. If you want chimes every quarter hour, Big Ben will give them to you, and they are sonorous. If you can put them on an amplifier or earphones, they're wonderful. And then there's Blip Blip for an hour chime, but it's not sonorous at all.
Dang.
CBC Listen.
Anybody else? Thank you, Tom.
Well, I'm only up to the bees.
I have a bird identifier, and you can identify songs. Merlin, Cornell Birdwatcher, and there's an All Trails app that gives you hiking trails.
That'd be one of those would be great if you wanted to give a presentation on the 12th on that, Carol. That'd be great.
Okay, well, I'm already doing the Gas Buddy, but I
Oh, that's true. Yes, you did mention it. Yeah, Gas Buddy is on the list for sure.
That's I right. can do more than one, but I didn't know what essential meant.
Well, it's essentials to you. Well, something that you find that, hey, this is a really cool app. I really use this, and maybe some other people in the group could use it too. That's really the focus of it. So anything that you find neat.
Okay.
What is Match 12th?
March 12th.
Oh, Match 12th, yeah.
Yeah.
it passed the spell check there, Bob.
Oh, sorry, that was me.
No, it means, is that some sort of singles group?
Microsoft Copilot did that one.
For Pauly singles groups.
Yeah.
But if anybody thinks of something in the next few days, it's not too late.
Yeah.
Really, it's not that 5 minutes, right?
Yeah, you can take 10 or 15 if you have something that is more lengthy, but if you have something that is short and sweet, like a five-minute presentation, a couple of slides, that you can just highlight, you know, what it is that you find cool about the app, and that'd be fine. And so if we have a whole bunch of five-minute presentations, that'd be wonderful.
Why don't you have a limit on it, like five slides?
Yeah, it's probably not a bad idea to say that people should be trying to limit it to, let's say, at most, a 10-minute presentation. So between 5 and 10-minute presentation, I think, would be sort of ideal. And we already have a few apps in there, but we could certainly get some more. Bea?
I'm not sure if I got it from Linda or somebody in this group, but I found the app called Seek, where you can take a picture with your camera or hold your camera up in front of a plant.
Yeah, I presented that in at Q&A already. Yeah, that's a great little app. Yeah, no problem. Cool. Yeah.
And if we don't have time for all of the apps, Natalie says, aside from the presentation, can we have a list of recommended ones that won't be presented?
That'd be an idea for sure, you know. Or people could present them at Q&A, at some Q&A after March 12th or Match 12th. So, yeah, I would encourage anybody to, if you have anything, I'll send it into suggestion box, and we'll take them first come, first serve. And, yeah, as Alan alluded to, if we don't have time to cover them all, we can at least put out a list, and we can schedule it for a Q&A following that to give your 5 or 10-minute presentation at that. So, everybody, your favorite apps that you think other people might be able to take advantage of. Let's get them in.
Give it some thought, and it'll help making your presentation, guaranteed.
Yep, we'll be happy to help you out with that if you need assistance in putting together some slides.
It'll be interesting.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, everybody. We will see you next week.
Yep. Night, everyone.
Bye.